Okay, everybody. Good morning. We'll get started if that's okay. So I've got a couple of housekeeping notes from the Institute before we kick off. So the first one is when you participate, and I hope there will be lots of discussion. Please use the microphone. The second one is to provide feedback for this and all sessions, and to use the app to do that. And here's another one. So there are some prizes at the conference, some competitions running. And if you haven't entered those, it's your last chance. So you click on the prize icon, and it could be you. Okay, so on to the business in hand. So there's been a minor issue here. So the Institute brings the bio for me to read. No, we all know Barry anyway, but and they've managed to bring my bio instead of Barry's. But fortunately,
I can introduce myself.
Fortunately, one of us spotted it. It would have been quite embarrassing if I started reading it. But so I'm going to read it off this little screen, just for those who don't know Barry. So Barry is the head of strategy and actuarial services at the Defence Health Fund, and is responsible for the development of strategies, provision of actuarial support, and successful operation of the Program Management Office. He has worked in private health insurance in Australia since 1998, and is actively involved seeking innovative ways to improve the health of the wider defence community. So please welcome Barry.
Okay. Thanks, Jamie, for the introduction, and everyone for attending this concurrent session. So today we're going to talk about how is private health insurance affordable in Australia. I guess affordability is always a very hot topic. However, I haven't really seen any consistent language or measure being used to discuss the issue. So what I would like to use this opportunity to introduce some measure around affordability and really bring the cost of health insurance to a typical household in the forefront. So with that in mind, I will just briefly touch on some of the points that I raised in my paper, which is on the screen. So including what is defining affordability, what is it? The affordability index that I created using in the paper, projection of future affordability level, and some research areas that are considered worthwhile to further enhance our understanding of this topic. But before we actually go into the formulas and all the actuarial stuff, I think it's actually worthwhile thinking about why we want to discuss affordability in the first place. So as you may all know, in Australia, we have a dual public and private healthcare system. Universal access to healthcare is provided under Medicare. Members of the public can also purchase health insurance to obtain treatment through the private systems. The government actually encourages the purchase and provides support to the industry, including the private health insurance rebate, lifetime health cover, which penalizes those who take out cover post age 30, and the Medicare levy surcharge. I guess as a result of the various carrots and sticks, around half of the Australian population has some form of health insurance. On the other hand, though, average industry premium increases has been increasing at a much faster rate than the consumer price index and average weekly earnings. So if you look at this graph here, for example, over the last 10 years to 2016, growth in insurance premium is 2.5 times the change in CPI and 1.5 times the change in AWE. So it's quite a big difference. So this disparity actually indicates a growing proportion of the household budget being consumed by health insurance. That leads to a national debate of whether health insurance is still affordable to the general public and the value that it brings to the members. Interestingly enough, despite all the public attention, there does not seem to be a consistent definition of affordability and how to measure it. So the aim of my paper is to utilize publicly available information to create a systematic measure of affordability, which enables all stakeholders to utilize consistent data and analysis in their discussions. So my exploration of this subject matter starts with the concept of affordability. The Oxford Dictionary defines affordable as inexpensive or reasonably priced. That implies a comparison of price and value that a person gets out of the purchase. This is not a very easy concept to apply in health insurance. On the value side, PHI can be seen as a financial risk mitigation product for medical events through hospital insurance, with a choice of doctors and shorter wait times for elective surgery, or a cash transfer mechanism which allows the purchaser to access everyday healthcare supplies and treatments through the general treatment policy, or a way to avoid future penalties imposed through legislation in the form of higher premium loadings for delayed purchase under lifetime health cover and the Medicare levy surcharge, or a combination of the above. So you can imagine health insurance, if it's a person, is a bit schizophrenic. On the price side, as health insurance is community rated, over time the insurers design products which offer different treatment coverage to appeal to different market segments. The variety of products available makes defining a benchmark premium for this exercise quite difficult. I guess the level of health insurance rebate introduces further complexity. The rebate level has started off with 30% flat. However, with successive government and changes to the rebate level and the legislation, the rebate actually currently takes into account the age of the policyholder, your taxable income, level of lifetime health cover loadings, and the CPI increases in any 1 year. So depending on the year and individual circumstances, different costs for policyholders will enjoy different level of government rebate, at the moment ranging from 0 to 34.579%. But despite the challenges in measuring value and price, I think it's still worthwhile developing the measure. Firstly, it provides a common language for stakeholders to communicate around affordability. Secondly, tracking affordability over time highlights any pressure that households may face in obtaining health insurance. So I took the plunge, I have a go at doing it. So what I did is I undertook a three-stage process to develop the measure. The first step is product classification. So we can group policies and define that benchmark premium for different categories of health insurance. I have chosen the system adopted by the Private Health Comparison website, which is powerhealth.gov.au, maintained by the Commonwealth Ombudsman. I must note, though, the classification that I used in the paper is no longer maintained because the government is thinking of a new classification system under the gold, silver, bronze categorization system. So we'll see how that goes. I guess the next step is selecting the right framework. So I look at a number of different frameworks, and the two that I want to talk about today or put in the paper are the Housing Industry Association Housing Affordability Index and the catastrophic method of measuring healthcare affordability. Based on these current calculation frameworks and the current health insurance environment, I came up with the formula to measure affordability, which is shown in the slide here. So the formula is there. It's actually quite important to understand the numerator and the denominator in the formula. So the numerator is the net premium that a policyholder actually pays. That is after the health insurance rebate has been taken into account. The denominator is the equivalized household income, which is available from the ABS. I decided to use this measure rather than average weekly earnings because it takes into account not only wages, but also government transfers like pensions and other income streams like annuity payments. I guess these transfers are quite important to the older age segments especially, who are frequent users of healthcare. I guess the concept of equalization is also very important here. As household size increases, consumption needs also increase, but there are also economies of scale. So an equivalent scale is used to adjust household income to take account of the economies that flow from sharing resources and enable more meaningful comparison across different households. So household income under this case is normalized to the level of a lone person household for a fairer comparison across different households in Australia. And the equalization process is also useful for this particular calculation. Because we're looking at the income of a lone person, we only need to consider the net premium of a singles policy for the numerator. So in the paper, I illustrated the application of this formula and the index using a number of different scenarios. So firstly, we want to establish the current level of affordability, which is shown in here. The first three scenarios assume the member purchased a top hospital and comprehensive extras combined policy under the classification system of the website, government website. And the fourth one assumes the member purchases a basic hospital and basic extras combined policy, again using the classification in the website. I guess the graph here shows the affordability index by different income quintiles across the four different scenarios for residents living in Victoria. The higher the index, the bigger the proportion of household income spent on health insurance, and thus less affordable to the segment concerned. You can draw a number of different conclusions out of this particular graph, but I want to point out two key ones. Over 5% of household income can be spent on an average top hospital and comprehensive general treatment combined policy under an average household income, average household in the population, which is under scenario A in the graph. But if you look at the most expensive comprehensive combined product in the market, that can consume approximately 12% of an average household income, which is quite a lot of money if you think about it. Another thing that I did as well is we look at affordability by age group, which is actually quite interesting. So assuming the person purchases an average top hospital and comprehensive extras combined policy, which is shown here. So again, the higher the index, the less affordable it is, i.e. high proportion of household income being consumed by health insurance. So you see a bit of a U-shaped curve occurring here. This is because household income actually follows an inverted U-shaped curve. So that is lower income at the younger and older age groups and high income for people in their 40s and 50s when they're in the working ages. One of the key of an interesting observation out of this particular graph is affordability of health insurance amongst the older age groups, which are frequent users of healthcare services and probably most required the maintenance of health insurance. Of course, in this particular graph, we do not take into account the household wealth that the older age group may have accumulated over time. But nevertheless, I think an interesting question to ask. I must note as well why an average household is not the best representation of a typical PHI or private health insurance purchaser. Nevertheless, it provides an indication of how affordable health insurance is to the general public. Another really useful application of index, I guess, is the ability to project future affordability and explore the implications on the sustainability of health insurance in Australia. So in the paper, I projected the affordability index over the next 20 years for a person who purchases top hospital and comprehensive extras combined policy under the age of 65 and receives the base tier of private health insurance rebate. Assuming the CPI will run at 2% per annum, I ran three different premium increase scenarios with ongoing gross premium increases of 4%, 6%, and 8% per annum. Not that one. So first things first. So this graph is looking at the level of private health insurance rebate that the member will receive over the next 20 years, expressed as a percentage of the gross premium. This is actually quite important because, as you can see, because the net premium payable by members is directly affected by the rebate level. As you can see, the higher the gross premium increases, the lower the rebate. This is because the rebate is only indexed at the CPI level and will not grow at the same rate as the health insurance premium under the three scenarios I selected. So for example, with the 4% premium increase scenario, which is under scenario A, the rebate will fall to around 18% of gross premium by 2036. If the premium grows at 8% per annum, the rebate will drop to 7% of gross premium. So again, those scenarios have a major impact on the net premium being paid by members. The next graph, look at the affordability index over the next 20 years. So again, high index, less affordable because higher proportion of income being used to pay for health insurance. As expected, under the scenario, I guess, health insurance is to become less affordable, and under the worst case scenario, which is scenario C and 8% premium increases per annum, nearly 25% of the average household income will be consumed by a comprehensive combined health insurance product. So again, you can make your own judgment about how affordable health insurance is going to be over the next 20 years based on some of these observations. The projection one of the key things I think this projection really raises is how sustainable health insurance is in Australia and what to do to arrest the declining affordability trend. Because with the current trajectory, I don't think people will be happy to pay 25% of their household income for a comprehensive combined policy. Last but not least, using this analysis as a starting point, I think there are many other research topics which is worth exploring. I've listed some of them here. Talk about it already. Things like state-by-state analysis of the affordability index. I only use Victoria as an example because that's the data that I've got, but if there's open access to the biohealth.gov.au information, I think doing a state-by-state analysis would be very interesting. because household income does vary between states, and of course, premium also vary between states. We have not taken into account explicitly the impact of excess and co-payments on affordability. So again, we expect that by including explicitly allowing for excess and co-payments in the calculation, it may affect the observations. Out-of-pocket is always an interesting one. And again, in this particular scenario, we only look at the premium being paid by members. But if you think about all the out-of-pocket that members may incur during an episode of care, that will just increase the level of, I guess, spend on health insurance, and again, make it less affordable. But what is the extent of that? One thing that I really would like to see is tracking of affordability over time, both from a historical perspective, but also into the future, because that would really indicate what is the level of stress the household is being put under in having health insurance over time. I mentioned about household wealth, and I think that is especially important in the older age groups, when they accumulate a certain amount of wealth, which is not included in the index. By including household wealth as well as household income, I think we'll have a much better gauge of the true affordability of health insurance. Another one which is quite interesting, and I found it will be quite useful, similar to the HIA Housing Affordability Index, really testing the threshold that a household will be under PHI stress. Now, we can make some hypotheses around what that proportion or what that index level may be, but it will be really interesting to really test that out in the market. Because if we can understand that threshold, we can use the index and say a certain proportion, flipping the index around and say X percent of the population is now under PHI stress. And I think that will be a very powerful indicator of health insurance affordability in the wider market. Analysis of the relationship between affordability index and participation. We already see a little bit of a drop in the participation over the last two quarters or so. I would be very interesting to see whether there's any relationship between the index and participation, and try to use that to project that towards participation in of health insurance in Australia. Last but not least, analysis of why health insurance premium increased so much. Again, I understand individual organisations or individual health funds may have done that piece of work, but through my research today, I haven't seen a very concise, I guess, comprehensive analysis of why health insurance premium is increasing at such a rate. I think that will be a very important piece of work that can be done to really understand, address the drivers, and make health insurance more sustainable. So that's the end of my presentation. So I hope you enjoyed my paper and my presentation today, and I'm happy to take any questions or feedback you may have on the paper. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot, Barry. I think it's a point you make in your paper. If we're going to have a discussion about affordability, then we need an understanding, a common understanding of what affordability is. And I think by starting this work, you have broken new ground here. So thank you for starting the discussion on that. So as Barry says, open the floor to discussions. If you'd like to say something, please just make your way to the microphone and please say your name before you make your question or comment. Who'd like to start?
Thank you, Barry, for your presentation. I think you provide us a possible view, possible measure that we can measure our affordability and do some further analysis. My question relates to one of your early slides about your definition about affordability. So for the index, as you explained, that was net margin divided by household income. So what is the other, like there was two components there. One is about price, the other about the value. So the utility, like a sort of concept, how was that related, reflect in your index calculation?
I think that's a very good question. I think that's why I'm taking one of the assumptions being made behind the paper is understanding different classification of health insurance policies. So in this case, I used the top hospital and comprehensive extras as a category of policy. One thing that I'll make an assumption around is if you purchase a higher level of cover, hopefully that will fit with your purpose and extract the right level of utility for the cohorts of members concerned. One of the flexibility that I did not mention in the research and the use of index, you can actually express different categories of policy as a percentage of household income and how look at it in that particular perspective. So in the paper, for example, I look at the basic cohort of policies, express it at as a proportion of the income and look at that. I look at the top end, and there may be different combinations. So we're making a bit of a proxy, I guess, in here with using the categorization to measure the utility that a member may get out of the product. So that's how I take into account the utility. Definitely not perfect. I don't think, again, this is another piece of work I think that's really worthwhile doing. I haven't seen a lot of work being done, being really fine-tuned in an ethical sense. What value do members really get out of health insurance? We understand the price. The premium is $2,000 for argument's sake. But I haven't really seen a piece of work in using numbers or any analytical method of understanding what do people get out of that $2,000. A lot of that will be intangible, I understand that, because people may purchase it for peace of mind. But we're able to put a number, I guess, on the value or the utility that we can get out of the purchase, combined with the index, I guess, I think we will have a very good understanding of the overall equation.
Hayden Burnow from Causeway. Thank you, Barry. Just following on that thought, people think about their car insurance premium, $1,000 on a $15,000 car, house insurance premium, $2,000 on a $500,000 house. So people are thinking about the P&L cost to them out of their budget and linking it to the balance sheet value of the asset that they're protecting. And I think for that reason that it doesn't sound... that they're not thinking of it so much in terms of their budget context. They're thinking of it in terms of what they're protecting. So is there potential for us to shift the conversation to the health asset that people are protecting, which most people, I'm sure, would value more than their house, in order to shift the affordability debate?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think people have in their mind a perceived value of their on the value of their health. I think some of the stuff I've seen in the past through in the health economics area, they do try to put a value on quality of life and things like that to assess whether a particular treatment is worthwhile from an economic sense. I'm not saying that is a perfect measure, but I think if we can do some work around put a dollar value, I guess, on the health asset, as Hayden said, or even the perceived value of health an individual wants to have, I think that will actually definitely change the perception of health insurance, because now you can compare the premium with that perceived value in the numbers sense, I guess, and definitely may potentially change how people perceive health insurance in general.
Andrew Gale. Thanks, Barry. I think that's a great start, and I really liked your last slide there with all the extra work that you want somebody else to do, which is great. I think you looked at Victoria, obviously they're amongst the highest premiums in the country, so if we looked at New South Wales, you get some lower numbers, but the concept is great. But I want us to start to think about the premise that spending more on health is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we know that we have been spending more and more of our nation's income, our personal income, on health over time. This is not a new thing. It's been going on for a long time. I'm sure there are people 10, 20 years ago talking about exactly the same thing you're talking about. So I think we will spend more of our income and our assets, and I particularly liked your reference to the older age group. Yes, they've got significant accumulated assets through the superannuation system. What are they going to spend a significant chunk of that on? On health, you know. Yes, they'll spend some on holidays and all the rest, but health is a significant chunk, so just looking at income for that group is really not going to be the best affordability index. And I think we really need to recognise that what we have here in PHI is really a product for the well-off and the wealthy, you know. It's not for everybody. We've got about half of the population in. They've got sizeable incomes and assets. They've got sizeable discretionary incomes. So I'd like just to sort of find a way of broadening it just from the premium to household income to the household budget for these people that have significant discretionary income. And, you know, so what's the dynamics there? Are they under stress because of this? What other things might they have to give up to continue with their health insurance? We know stories about people at the bottom end of income, people on age pensions, you know, they almost go without heating to keep their private health insurance. I'm not talking about that group. That's not our main group. The people that might have to curtail their overseas holidays to once every 2 years rather than one to maintain their private health insurance. Is that an affordability crisis? I don't know. What we need to have, of course, is to make sure that we don't lose some of the incentives, government incentives that just tip people in rather than out, like the MLS, like the rebate. So I suppose I'd say affordability has been decreasing for a long time, but we've had 45% of the population for 17 years. Yes, there's been more downgrading happening, but affordability is something we should look at, but I'd like to take it a bit broader to the household budgets of the well-off who have lots of discretionary income.
I think thanks for that, Andrew. I think one of the fundamental questions that the government has failed to answer is what is the role of health insurance in the overall healthcare system? Because again, from all the rhetoric that have been put out by the government, it does not seem that health insurance should be preserved just for the well-off. So if we now change the tone to say health insurance only for the well-off or become a luxury item, they already changed the equation altogether. I think that there's a fundamental question that we should ask and a fundamental debate that needs to be had. I agree with you, though, around expanding the insurance premium to a wider range of costs that are associated with healthcare, because there's a lot of hidden costs, not just on health insurance in general, that people need to encounter when they access healthcare services. You got your out-of-pocket. In this case, you can even include your outpatient out-of-pocket because there's a fair bit of that going on. Interestingly enough, if you look at the AIHW data, if you look at private funding of healthcare services, if you look, the majority of private funding is now being used, is actually coming out of people's pocket, not of health insurance. So then you raise a fundamental question around how much further can people take, not just paying premium, but also have out of pocket to pay for healthcare services. What would the overall impact of that on their household income, on the affordability of healthcare in general in Australia?
Ben Uy from DBN. Just sort of addressing, I guess, waste and being efficient. Have you thought of, you know, modifying the index to somehow take into account value for money or efficient use of the health spend? You know, like, I guess you've sort of looked at you spend money and you get something for it. It may or may not be valuable, we don't know, but nevertheless it's spent, and then that's, you know, a proportion of your income. But could the formula be sort of modified or adjusted so that it's spent on efficient health outcomes?
I think this is an area where health economics do better than us to a certain extent, I would imagine. I think there's several things in here. As I mentioned before in the presentation, health insurance is sort of have a bit of a bipolar situation here. It's not around treating people. You got a penalty or a legislative side of it. You got a general treatment side of it, which is not necessary for a catastrophic event. Unlike looking at efficiency of, say, you know, surgeries or even particular medical treatment, I find it difficult to define efficiency in health insurance. Efficiency, defining efficiency in the first place is important in health insurance. What is meant by efficiency in health insurance sense? If I go to Specsavers and get a no-gap glasses, is that efficient? If I go to having a baby and need to pay $5,000, is that efficient? Because you're actually better off because, you know what, if you don't have this, you're going to have a $10,000 pocket. So what is meant by efficient? And from what perspective are you looking at efficiency? Is it from the overall system perspective or from a member's perspective? So I think the first thing is to understand what efficiency really means and what role does health insurance play in delivering efficient services. If you can overcome those two questions and have some kind of measurement of efficiency, then I think you can combine that measure of efficiency into the index and make it a more powerful argument in the public policy area.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. It gave a lot of food for thought. I have a question just around the consistency of definitions in health insurance, because there's different excesses, different coverages, different restrictions. What are your thoughts on how members are able to assess the value proposition of insurance when there are so many differences?
I think the first thing is you have to have a chat with the government on this, and especially with the advisory committee that they have just set up. But I can give you my two cents worth on it. I think members do not really understand health insurance. Actually, members do not really understand health, for a start. They don't understand the difference between inpatient and outpatient. They don't understand how Medicare works in some cases. They don't understand how health insurance interact with the healthcare providers. Start with that first. Yes, there's a plethora of restrictions, exclusions, things like that, but most people do not understand the terminology used in the brochures. They don't understand what joint replacement actually covers. They don't understand what is bariatric surgery. What is that? Only until when they need bariatric surgery, they understand what is bariatric surgery. That's the second thing. The third thing is, I think because of committee rating, people are now designing the product to such a way that you can just maybe exclude one or two particular procedures and that becomes a new product. So that doesn't help because you have lots of similar kind of thing but with like minor differences between them. That doesn't help in terms of the confusion level. Another interesting observation, especially over the last few years, addressing that, is actually the rise of aggregators. I think one of the reasons why people are using aggregators is because people do not understand. If you look at the amount of sales being put through aggregators nowadays for health insurance versus, say, 5 or 10 years ago, I think that already gives you an indication how confused members of the public is on this particular issue. So I understand, as I mentioned before in the presentation, the government is thinking about how to, I guess, better classify products. For the Private Health Ministerial Advisory Committee using the gold, silver, bronze classification. But I'll be very interested in what they come up with and how that will help consumer understand your health insurance in general.
Hi. I'm Gail Ganane, Police Health. A comment, first of all, and then a question, I suppose. The comment, first of all, is, I agree with you that people really don't understand their health insurance and health insurance product, which is also why so many of the products out there are now actually dangerous with some of the exclusions in there, because people really don't understand what their likely health effects are likely to be, and then they blame the health insurer when they discover that they're not covered for bariatric surgery and that's what they need. So, there's a real risk, I think, for us as an industry in offering too many exclusionary products that don't actually go to the heart of the fact that people really don't necessarily make good decisions about where their health is likely to go. My question is really, I thought the affordability index is a really good idea, and I suppose my question is how we find a way to feed that back into the Department of Health and into the policymakers so that they actually understand that. There's still, as you say, more work to do, but I know the Department of Health does not do this kind of analysis because they don't have the time, they don't have the resources. So it's a question of how we get that information back into them so that they can start thinking about it, because I think this would probably scare the heck out of the minister from the perspective of, if this becomes unaffordable, then the consequences of that into the public system are really huge, much, much higher than the cost of the subsidy that they're using to keep people in private health insurance. So what do we do to make sure that we can get some of this information to the policymakers?
That's an interesting one, I think. I think one of the key things is sharing that information with our industry associations, which is Private Healthcare Australia and HERMA, because they do have a seat, for example, at the advisory committee. They also have connections with the Department of Health. I think this is quite a useful piece of information to put on the table, not just for health insurers, but also all stakeholders in healthcare in general. because I think people all realize that the system in general is unsustainable. I think there's no doubt around that. Everyone at the table, whether it's private hospitals, medical device providers, suppliers, health insurers, you name it, everyone understand that. But I think if we can just put this type of information on the table and show how dangerous this is going to be over the next, say, 10 to 20 years, I think that will really prompt, hopefully will prompt more action, I guess, in really finding a way out of this. So I agree with you, Gail. We really need to put that in front of policymakers and through our industry associations and really urge that level of reform required to make this more sustainable.
Thanks, Barry. I'm Aidan Morrison from the Youngster Initiative. I wanted to actually ask about the risk of increasing inclusions, actually, particularly for kind of things that might be seen as something more like a prepayment service for expected sort of types of things, such as dental work or physiotherapy or other types of things that might be preventative but also could be counted on. Because it seems like a consumer, when choosing a policy and assessing their utility, might have a particular premium for known clear costs that they're planning to incur that might be substantially offset. So have you considered trying to measure or gauge whether there's a displacement from private expenditure on consuming health services and kind of their insurance there, or is that a sort of an additional dimension for your analysis? And also wanted to get your thoughts on whether maybe the cost of essentially the health insurance rebate to the government might sort of substantially increase if a greater proportion of people's health expenditure does sort of end up being sort of channeled through insurance or sort of, you know, more preventative services acted sort of offered by insurers.
So I think I guess there's two questions in here. A is the role of, I guess, general treatment or excess policy in the total scheme of things, especially in terms of the value that members may put on it. So that's your first question. And the second question is, what is the role of preventative health and whether we will save money through providing more preventative health for health insurance? And so I'll answer those two questions. So hopefully I understand the question correctly. The first one, I think, is hard, I think, because people purchase extras for different reasons. Some people treat that more like a cash, like a bank account, I guess. I put $600 in premium, I get $800 out of treatment, I'm happy. Some people being coerced in buying it because we're through the sales process and may not really understand what they get out of extras. Sometimes that does happen. And I can also understand from my experience there's a bit of set and forget as well. So people actually purchase extras at the start of their relationship with the health insurer or health insurance, but forget that they have coverage. So there's that. I would imagine the utility that members may get will vary between these three categories of members. So, for example, let's say I'm a frequent user of a general treatment policy. What value do I get on? What value do I get from a remedial massage? What value do I get from a physiotherapy session? Different people have different perceived value, I guess, of those treatments. And most of them, I would imagine, will be intangible. So I think understanding utility of general treatment will be quite interesting exercise. Don't get me wrong. But I think it will be quite a big exercise. But I'm not saying it's not doable. But I think that's really something worth thinking about. And coming back to my point about health insurance being bipolar, you have general treatment, which is coming back to the everyday utility that you get from a massage, probably it's frequent but small, from a big utility that you get from a major event. How do people weigh between them when you have a combined policy? How do you add them together in the most appropriate way? I think these are some of the interesting questions we need to ask ourselves. Talking about preventative health, I think that's another interesting one. I think there's two things here. A, the legislative framework that health insurers can play within, that allows health insurers to play from a preventative sense. I think that's an interesting one to think about. Another one again from my personal experience working with health insurer is, if you go out and help people with preventative health, do they actually accept your help? Because there's actually this sounds really bad, but there's actually a certain level of skepticism towards health insurance in the general public. If you come out and help people to have better health, not that it's a bad thing, but one of the questions they may ask is, why do you want to do this with me? why are you interested in my health? I think there's a prerequisite. We want people to, if you want health insurer to have to provide preventative health services, I would imagine one of the key things is actually changing the brand of health insurance in the first place. If you're not able to convince members, we're here to help you, we're not here to big brother you, I think there will be an important step before you provide health, preventative health services and engage your members in a positive way.
Yeah, Brent Walker. Full marks to you, Barry. Fancy having to queue up to the microphone. That's probably the only concurrent session where this will occur. So, full marks to you for having to get people to queue up. There's no doubt from the work that you've done that within 5, 10, maybe 15 years at the most, depending on how fast the premiums grow in the next few years, there's going to have to be some changes. And I think we have to be proactive rather than reactive. We shouldn't be sitting on our butts saying, oh, woe is us, we're going to have to change the product, because we've got to make sure the changes don't destroy the product. If you look at the product that we have at the moment, about 80% of the money that we collect goes out in hospital claims. The majority of that, almost all of it, to private hospital claims. And that's where we have to obviously concentrate. Now, I don't think there's any point any longer in trying to screw the private hospitals anymore. That's a silly exercise, because we need them. We need them to, and we need them to make a profit too. Not too much, but we need them to make a profit. I think, and I'm going to throw this challenge up to everybody in the room, I think we have to be in the private hospital sector helping them work out how to make hospitals more efficient. A lot more efficient. We need to get a 20% efficiency dividend from private hospitals, and not by screwing them, screwing the costs, the benefits down, but by actually making them perform 20% more effectively. Mm. Now, I don't know how we're going to do it, but that's the challenge, I think, for the profession. Otherwise, in 20 years' time, in 2037, when I'm here, I'll be passing my hat around for you guys to all put chips of money in so I can still afford my private health insurance.
Thank you, Brent, for the comment. I think I agree with that. I think, again, another piece of work that I've not seen, because in terms of public policy, is a really good understanding of the supply chain within healthcare. No one really understands how things actually work within the hospital sector or even provider sector. No one really understands where costs being incurred and how the margin being added along the supply chain. I think a good understanding of that will be a very good step. In terms of efficiency, I think definitely it's interesting to understand the differences in the public sector and the private sector in terms of hospital sense and the different ways of they being funded. In the hospital, I guess this is my personal observation, I may be wrong. I think in the public sector, don't get me wrong, both public and private sector try the best they can, I guess, run efficiently. One of them for budget, one the other for profit margin. Will be interesting to actually look at how efficient the public hospitals are versus private hospitals are, and whether the sectors can actually borrow from each other the best ideas. I think that's definitely a piece of work worth pursuing in terms of increasing the efficiency of the overall hospital sector.
Mm. Hi, Barry. I think it might be the last one. I'm Brendan Pond here. Great paper. I think it's a good conversation starter, and a lot of more work to be done, obviously. One of the points that I'd like to raise is I think it would be interesting to have some sort of context as whilst this paper focuses on the impact on household budgets, if we look at the whole health system in totality, it's obviously costing governments a lot of money to fund health. And in 20 years' time, if we're saying that it could potentially be 20% or 25% of household budgets, what are we expecting the government's overall cost of health And in the same graph, what would our the current rebate be at the moment, compared to 25 years' time? So if we're going to be seeing a growth from 7% to 25% of the household, is that a major issue in the context of the overall national health budget growing to either a high or a lower? And I think that will then drive further conversations as is the current rebate system, is that a fair and sustainable system? And is it something that then should be changed and based on where the overall health budget, national health budget is going?
Thank you for that, Brandon. I think it's, again, a good comment. from what I've seen today in terms of some of the research I've done, definitely a good, I mean, there's some statistics around the proportion of GDP being spent on health in general in Australia. And of course, it's likely to go upwards rather than downwards over time. But again, coming back to my point a bit earlier, I think it's actually quite important before we to understand how that money is being spent across the different healthcare providers or healthcare services, and how is it being delivered efficiently, and more importantly, what's the best way to fund that services. Again, there's a lot of conversation recently, depending on who you talk to, around the efficiency of the rebate in funding healthcare. Is it the right amount of money? Shouldn't we just put all of that into public hospital? Again, depending on the different stakeholders that you talk to, everybody seems to have a very different view. But again, I haven't seen a very fundamental piece of well-being saying what is the best way to fund. I mean, I sort of seen that through the National Health Reform Commission under Christine Bennett, and try to understand and try to start a conversation around funding in general. But again, I don't think there's, maybe just me, I haven't seen a lot of work being done on that, despite all the raging debate around whether the rebate is best spent on this or that. So I think the understanding the role of health insurance is important. Sorry, understanding healthcare and who should deliver, what's the best way to deliver healthcare is important. Funding of healthcare is important. And what's the best way to get the right funding mix to fund that level of service, to meet consumer expectation? So I think these are some of the fundamental questions that we need to ask in the public policy arena.
Okay, thanks everybody. As a group, we've timed to perfection. Lots of great discussion from the floor. It's time for lunch. Barry, there's a drink there to have with your lunch. And please join me in thanking Barry.
Thank you.